today on Against the Grain. Can we innovate our way out of poverty and deprivation? Can problems of development be tackled with entrepreneurial and technocratic approaches? And what can professional design do for poor people and communities, and what can't it do? I'm CS. UC San Diego professor Lily Irani joins me to discuss her book, Chasing Innovation, Making Entrepreneurial Citizens in Modern India, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We hear it all the time. Innovation and entrepreneurialism will deliver us to the promised land, will help us tackle the dilemmas facing humankind, will spark and furnish the bright ideas and products and infrastructures that will uplift us all, including poor people. Technocratic, expert-driven approaches are, we are told, the key to addressing thorny problems of development. Professional designers can figure out and make real the kinds of things poor and marginalized communities need. What should we make of this rhetoric? How should we interpret this discourse, often emanating from the halls of power and the mouths of experts and technocrats? And what happens to oppositional and subversive politics and movements when the language and methods of expert-driven innovation are championed? Lily Irani is Associate Professor of Communication and Science Studies at the University of California, San Diego. Her new book is Chasing Innovation, Making Entrepreneurial Citizens in Modern India. The book looks at, among other things, who gets ignored and what goes unaddressed in the drive to innovate our way out of poverty and inequality. When Lily Irani joined me recently in studio, I brought up the subtitle of her book, Making Entrepreneurial Citizens in Modern India, and asked what she means by entrepreneurial citizenship.
As I was deciding to frame the book around entrepreneurial citizenship, what I was trying to get us to ask about is, how did it become the case that entrepreneurship is the way that we're all supposed to imagine improving the communities that we live in? And how did entrepreneurship become something that wasn't just about business, undertaking new management ventures, but also about national belonging, about participating and building up something like a nation? And so that's why I have citizenship in there. So the concept is supposed to get us to ask a question about something I see happening in a lot of different countries, where entrepreneurship is a way we're supposed to build up our communities.
Oh, I see. So entrepreneurship in the sense of doing something, not just to make a profit, but to improve the nation.
Mm-hmm.
The way you get to entrepreneurial citizenship, or maybe I should say the way in which entrepreneurial citizenship gets highlighted by, for example, governments, is, in India's case, we're going to focus on India because that's the focus of your book, is liberalization, right? The liberalization of India's economy. Maybe before we talk about that, can you give us a brief sense of what India's economy was like prior to liberalization?
Yeah, prior to liberalization, India's economy is commonly talked about as a planned economy where you have the government that's supposed to rein in private industry. There was still private industry in the Indian state post-independence. It was a state that was supposed to have socialist values, that was supposed to be accountable to something other than profit, which is to raise up poor people and give them access to schooling and healthcare. But the agreement that happened with independence was that land and industry wasn't going to be taken away from the big private industrialists. The state could start its big industries, and the state could also regulate how private industry worked. So liberalization was the process of forcing India, at a time when it had a kind of a foreign exchange crisis, to accept structural adjustment and start selling off some of its national industries, and also loosening regulations and allowing private companies to have a lot more latitude in how they plan, how they're going to make profits and how they're going to employ people. But actually, one of the things that happens a lot is that we assume that 91 is when this started, but it really got started under Indira Gandhi back in the 80s. Arvind Rajagopal has a great paper about how Indira Gandhi kind of wanted to unleash the power of business, made it harder for workers to go on strike, And the administration was working on laying the groundwork for what finally in 91 kind of was formally announced as official national policy.
What did the liberalization of India's economy do to the way that private entrepreneurs were viewed, by the government?
Yeah, that was something that was really interesting for me, because coming from growing up in California, you just hear entrepreneurship used as a positive word all the time. But I went back and looked, I just read a whole bunch of India's five-year plans from independence to the most recent one. And I was tracing how the meaning of the word entrepreneur changed over time. And so before liberalization, entrepreneurs might be engineers who've gone to engineering school but can't find jobs and might need to self-employ. Or it could be people who are like local small medium businesses. And the Planning Commission, this is India's central planning agency, in these documents, like, actually saw entrepreneurs as sort of suspicious. Like, maybe they're not going to use common resources well. They're going to be motivated to get quick profits. You know, they did have programs to train people in entrepreneurship to create jobs for themselves, where the government couldn't necessarily create a big, you know, state industry to employ people. But there was not a sense that entrepreneurship was the way you organize how resources get made into the stuff people need to eat and survive. And that really changed after liberalization.
And it changed in what way? In what more positive light were entrepreneurs viewed?
So in the planning documents, and also in work that political scientist Lata Varadarajan has done, where she's tracing parliamentary discussions and controversies around liberalization, you have a lot of examples of the central government telling domestic industrialists who don't want to compete against foreign companies, hey, you know, you can be like the entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley. Look at what they've been able to achieve. You should simmer down about us exposing you to foreign competition. For people who asked, well, who's going to build roads? Who's going to build the kinds of infrastructures that have been the responsibility of the state? What you see in these planning documents is the invocation of this like entrepreneur that's going to come up and start taking on the responsibilities that the state had been taking on and using private industry and profit to build those infrastructures that the nation needs. So entrepreneurs, after liberalization, kind of became this catch-all for the people who are going to do the work that the socialist state was saying is not going to do anymore.
So they drew back because the public sector was taking a backseat to private enterprise. Is that right?
Yeah, they drew back because they wanted to produce higher rates of economic growth, and because the government was in a situation where it no longer had, it ran out of the kinds of foreign reserves that it needed, and it had to take a loan from the IMF. And the terms of that loan included the stipulation that the state pull back from some of these functions, which happened in lots of countries around the same time under structural adjustment.
And then there's, of course, the drive toward development, toward helping poor people out of poverty. India's government justifiably is concerned about, you know, millions and millions of people in poverty and what they do to the economy, and just, you know, their own personal welfare and what happens in terms of nutrition and education. What potential did development experts in India see? What opportunity did they see presented itself in the idea and the practice of helping poor people?
I think the way that experts saw poor people in this kind of century-long project of development that India, like other countries, has been undertaking, what the responsibility to and the role of poor people was kind of shifted is what I observed. So there's a famous quote where Nehru talks about the nation as full of needy masses, like mouths to feed. So 1947, after independence, Kavita Philip has written about this. The ideal citizens among the poor were those who would farm and produce the food of the nation, or would go to factories and would produce the things that the nation needs to eat or use or drive. After 1991, poor people were still seen as a group of people that need to participate in the workforce, but you have an acknowledgement that there's really high unemployment. There's this recognition since the 70s in places like the International Labor Organization that there's a massive informal economy, and all these people who are supposed to be working in the kind of planned productivity of the nation are not going to enter into where the planners can see them and taxes can be charged and like inputs and outputs can be all like regulated. So you get a lot of policies that are about regulating people in the informal economy, providing them with some kinds of empowerment programs, resources, sometimes food, like controlling reproduction to make sure there's not too many poor people is a very violent part of the history of economic development. And then you get this shift with microfinance in the early 2000s, where all of a sudden poor people come to be seen as an opportunity. They come to be seen as borrowers first. Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee have written about this as like a space where big finance felt comfortable getting involved with development because they could give loans to poor people at 25% interest rates. And so that's when you get kind of like microfinance, Kiva.org. I was living in the Bay Area. A lot of us thought, oh, we could give loans to poor people and then they could start their own businesses. And then a few years after that, you get like the mid to late 2000s, you get Goldman Sachs and other big consulting firms writing reports about the rising middle classes and what a huge consumer market they're going to be in lots of different countries for American companies who are seeing flagging consumer demands. So that those rising middle classes come to be seen as a market. Product designers need to go out and start researching what Indian consumers want. And then business school professors like C.K. Prahlad write books like The Fortune of the Bottom of the Pyramid saying, you know what, poor people can be consumers too. Not just borrowers, not just business creators, but also consumers. So that creates this idea of poor people, not just as people who are entitled to benefits because of dispossession or because, you know, they need to have access to education and food to participate fully as citizens, but in fact as a market of borrowers and consumers where you can do development and make a profit at the same time. And that's a new idea in the last couple of decades.
And where does innovation come in? What is innovation's relationship to the kinds of entrepreneurship that the Indian government was encouraging, presumably is still encouraging, in order to improve the lives of communities, including poor communities?
Mm-hmm. Thinking about what innovation means and how institutions use that term in the name of kind of projects to get people to act or build or produce in a certain way was one of the thorniest parts of the book, because innovation could mean things like new music and new art. And I was looking at I went back to old newspapers from the 1900s to see like how is the meaning of the word changing, and could mean new religious movements. But there was this move in the 50s with modernization projects to get people in the developing world to like absorb new farming technologies, absorb new kinds of tools. And innovation became something that was not about a new way of thinking or aesthetics, but actually about new kinds of things. And how do you get people to use those new kinds of things? And then when I was reading these five-year plans, innovation then kind of takes this turn where in the mid-2000s, it comes to really be associated not just with making new things that people find useful, but making new things that people find useful that you can patent. In the mid-2000s, you had the World Trade Organization and the U.S. really behind it pushing intellectual property laws that served the needs of Microsofts and the record industry in the United States, because the internet was happening and people all over the world were downloading our stuff. So you get this push to create innovation culture that's really about patent culture and about intellectual property and innovation as the kinds of making of new knowledge and things that can be monopolized and then sold on the market as assets.
Lily Irani joins me in studio. She's Associate Professor of Communication and Science Studies at the University of California, San Diego. We are talking about her new book, Chasing Innovation, Making Entrepreneurial Citizens in Modern India. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You've written about a number of statements in, I think, the last decade that are sort of emblematic of where India is going in terms of the view it's taking toward innovation and entrepreneurship. One of them is by someone named Pitroda. What views did he express on how poor people in India could or should be helped?
Sam Pitroda is an engineer and an entrepreneur who was based in the U.S., but was really involved in helping India's Congress Party in the 80s set up village phone booths and building infrastructure that got most Indians onto telecommunication networks. And so he often represents this view, you know, as the head of what was then the National Innovation Commission, like the 2010s, that Indian engineers are people who have had access to education from the state, and they can build the things that poorer Indians need. So the things that get produced in the first world are not necessarily the things that best serve the needs of Indians. And so Indian engineers should devote their talents to those things that their own fellow citizens require.
And so the innovation would be done then by these experts, by these educated folks, and not necessarily by the rural masses.
That's right.
And then there was a professor named Anil Gupta. He has strong opinions about what rural India has to offer. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so for Anil Gupta, someone who worked in rural areas of India for a long time as a banker, and he actually studied in a university that was very committed to Indian and indigenous knowledge. You know, his idea is that rural people actually have all kinds of inventions that experts who are educated in cities or living in cities would never come up with, because they're not with those plants, they're not with the agricultural capacities of that region, they're not engaged in those practices that rural people are engaged in. So for 20 years, as an Indian Institute of Management professor, he was leading these trips, having students walk around India, identify rural innovators who make really interesting medicines or pedal-powered washing machines, and helping document those inventions and then translating newsletters that document those inventions and advice for rural innovation into a whole bunch of vernacular languages. So he was very committed to creating a kind of rural connectivity and idea sharing. And eventually, with all these intellectual property regimes that got imposed in India, he actually pushed to develop special kinds of IP licenses where poor people could patent something that they'd invented, but they could give it out to other kind of individuals for free, but they could still collect royalties from big companies. So he even created new licensing mechanisms, basically, to let poor people continue to do the cultures of sharing and knowledge production that they had been engaging in, while also making sure they were compensated for their inventions when big corporation took up some of this indigenous knowledge.
Okay, so that's Gupta in a nutshell. We talked about Sam Pitroda. And then the third view you bring up here is that of Arvind Subramanian. He was a former International Monetary Fund economist, chief economic advisor to Prime Minister Narendra Modi from 2014 to 2018. That's when he was an advisor to Modi. Now, he said some things that I think we might expect from an IMF economist. Can you encapsulate that? And also, what I find curious is that you find some kind of a similarity, like a connecting thread between him and Pitroda and Gupta, despite what seem to be different messages.
Yeah, so Subramanian, he wants to support the high-tech industry in creating the Twitters of India, of creating big call centers, really relying on entrepreneurs to create value, create businesses kind of however he sees fit. And his real concern was job creation. Like, what he wants to do is create lots of employment for poorer people around India, but not necessarily highlighting the ways that the kinds of things that people might need to consume or produce within India might be unique, like based on the cultural needs. So Pitroda and Subramanian in this panel that I was watching kind of go at it, because Pitroda has this idea of, like, engineers create good things for people, and Subramanian is really more about economic, like, financial value. Like, how do you create economic growth as financial value and as jobs? And there's not kind of like this moral developmental dimension to creating the kinds of production that we need. But the similarity I find between Gupta with his focus on rural innovators, Pitroda with his focus on highly trained and virtuous engineers, and Subramanian with his focus on the people who can create the Twitters or the big next call center innovation of India, is that they all believe that there's this class of people called innovators who are able to, in some ways, be ahead of the curve or see opportunity and take other people's needs maybe into account, whether it's through the market, through being an engineer going listening to poor people, or through being a poor person who listens to other poor people who use the kinds of things that you create. And that innovator leader is the person that needs to be supported. They're the ones who deserve the honor of the state. They should get entrepreneurship awards. There should be entrepreneurship skill trainings. And we should celebrate the model where you have somebody who kind of like comes out and takes charge and takes credit for what is, you know, in my view, ultimately, like really widely distributed social creativity that often isn't structured like a person with a good ear and a vision who knows how to scale up the new thing that we find useful.
Okay, so if all these three people were, in a sense, guided by the same vision of innovation and entrepreneurs and elevating these figures, what disturbs you about this? I mean, what's wrong with trying to get people to apply their expertise as experts to problems that they perceive to be out there in communities and marginalized communities and poor communities, and thereby helping the nation, building the nation through this kind of work that maybe just happens to profit themselves, profit the entrepreneurs?
I think the first issue I take with it is the idea that, you know, how we come together and create the resources that we need to live needs to be guided by where economic value can be found. You know, in economies that are highly unequal, that means that the opportunities to make money, put simply, are going to be, you know, what people who have money will pay for. And I kind of saw that happen over and over in some of the projects that I looked at in my book, where there are certain problems that people had that they needed actually engineering help with, but they weren't problems that were seen as marketable enough to a wide enough set of consumers to kind of follow up on. The other issue I have is one that's about democracy. So when you have the innovators who are the ones that the government wants to identify, they want to support, they want venture capital to support them. Those innovators, one of the things I talk about in the book is how like the idea of that innovator as the person who can see the future that other people can't see, as the person who can like take in what's going on culturally or what a community's needs are and kind of like forge forth with a promising new vision. That's kind of an inheritor to the planning state, where you have the planning commission doing statistical calculations and deciding what's objectively right for the nation, when the planning state also is people who had tons of caste and class privilege that was shaping what they thought was right for the nation. But now, instead of having that be part of a government institution, which is not that democratically accountable to begin with, now it's even less democratically accountable because you've got a bunch of entrepreneurs who are going around saying, I think this would be the amazing thing for the community that I'm speaking in the name of. And the only process that holds them accountable is whether they get an investment or not to scale up that vision that they have. So I think it was kind of a democratic problem. And this came up all kinds of ways when I was doing my field work. Like, how many times did I hear people talk about Steve Jobs as a model of the person who like produces amazing designs but doesn't want to do design by committee? Committees just ruin vision. There's a kind of autocratic streak, kind of supporting the idea that a visionary leader needs people to just get out of their way so they can produce nice things for us. And I feel that's basically entrepreneurship in a nutshell, however ungenerous that may seem.
Lily Irani is her name. She teaches communication and science studies at UC San Diego. We're talking about her book, Chasing Innovation. We'll take a short break and speak more with Lily about her book. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Lily Irani joins me in studio, I-R-A-N-I, Associate Professor of Communication and Science Studies at the University of California, San Diego. Her research examines the cultural politics of high-tech work and the counter-practices they generate. And she's got a book out. It's called Chasing Innovation, Making Entrepreneurial Citizens in Modern India. It's published by Princeton University Press. So a good portion of your book is devoted, Lily, to the everyday work practices of a New Delhi design consultancy that you call Dev Design. So you followed the studio over 5 years. You worked there daily for 11 months. You bring up Dev Design and the people who work there in order to do what? In order to show what entrepreneurial citizenship looks like?
Yeah, with Dev Design, I wanted to show what entrepreneurial citizenship looks like, but also what it feels like for people who gave up jobs. A lot of them, you know, are middle class, educated in India, grew up with a lot of these nation building ideals, and then, you know, ended up after liberalization getting jobs at big consumer product companies, Pepsi Cola, working on slides in the back office for McKinsey, like, you know, running a call center. And they chose to come and start this design studio because they actually didn't like those jobs that liberalization gave them. They felt like they were just doing the work that Americans wanted to outsource, and there wasn't any room to actually express themselves or address the needs that they saw in their communities. And so they're answering this call that the state and elites are making, say, well, if you want to make something better, do it by becoming an entrepreneur. So I wanted to show what contradictions that creates in their own lives, what kinds of ways they invest their hope and then get burned out, what it looks like over 5 years when you're doing a project where every few months, it seems like the project's going okay, and you're telling the client what users need, and you're really trying to make technology or products better for people as a designer. But then somehow at the end of 2-3 years, the thing that you heard people really say they need, like, never seems to quite get built. And that's kind of a hard thing to see when you're actually working in those spaces. I myself worked as a designer for 4 years. So the book kind of offered a chance to take a longer view and step back and ask, okay, what is this adding up to when we're investing ourselves in finding new ways to create value for companies and investors?
Give us some examples of what Dev Design did and what kinds of services it offered to its clients.
Yeah, what Dev Design did was often help clients figure out what kinds of products or services the clients already kind of knew how to make, whether it's like shampoo or watches or, you know, pharmaceuticals for diabetes. And how do you design them, redesign them, and market them to people in India or to people in, actually sometimes in other parts of what was called the developing world, like Africa, Indonesia. So they would go out and interview people that are potentially target audiences. They would look at how they use products in their homes, what their daily routines were like, and they figured out ways to fit the kinds of things that companies know how to manufacture into the daily patterns and practices of people's, like, everyday lives.
And how important was doing work that uplifted disadvantaged people? How important was that kind of work to studio members?
I think it was really important for them. It was the thing that made it worth getting paid a lot less than working at Pepsi or working at McKinsey. One of my friends who was at the studio was saying, like, how when she first started doing design work with the studio, they were actually getting contracts for, like, Coca-Cola. You know, how can Coca-Cola market its energy drink to, like, Indian club goers or something? And she wasn't really that into those projects, but you had to keep the lights on. And then when they started getting these contracts to work for kind of philanthrocapitalist efforts to create new water filters and things, she said, you know, my grandma understands what I do now. My grandma understands, like, this is the kind of thing that we're supposed to be doing to, like, make India this kind of post-colonial project that can be independent and thriving. So, and that investment that they had as this work as being something that's more than just a job is the kind of thing that kept people at work for 14 hours a day sometimes, and kind of traveling around for weeks at a time and not necessarily always, like, getting to see their friends or families. I mean, they worked really, really hard to make these projects go as well as possible.
Yeah, you're right that the employees, that the staffers at DevDesign, this, again, this consultancy firm, this design consultancy firm in New Delhi, were obsessed with the idea of adding value. So that's kind of what gave their working lives purpose?
Yeah, adding value, I mean, it wasn't so much that they were obsessed with it. It was more that I had noticed that adding value just became an everyday way of asking whether you're doing the right thing or not. And actually, I've observed that in Bay Area too. People say, well, like, you know, what value is this person adding to the project? Or like, what value would I add if I pitched for that project, right? And so they would ask themselves like all the time, you know, like retreats and things like, okay, like here's the kind of projects we've been doing, but is this really the value that we can be adding? Should we be describing what we do to clients in a different way so that we get different kinds of projects from them? But they would also ask it of each other, like, you know, an intern gets hired and she's on working on a probationary basis, and the question would be like, well, okay, but, you know, what value is this person adding? So one of the pressures that are created in the studio was like, one, to kind of always be adjusting what the studio is doing to follow what the latest trends are from clients and investors. It's like following the sun, but the sun is capital. And then the other pressure that it created was for individuals in the studio who hadn't yet established, you know, the kind of faith that like they belong there and they should be kept on a more permanent basis. Like those people felt like they needed to, and they were constantly asked to kind of not just do the work, but demonstrate that they're doing the work, contribute a lot of ideas during the brainstorms, make sure that they're like putting in the face time and making the documents and deliverables and make them look like they're actually adding value rather than, say, like quietly contributing on like the less sexy tasks or listening really actively and helping people synthesize points of view, but not really like adding a lot of new ideas to the mix. Like there are certain kinds of personalities that tended not to do well when people were constantly asking each other, well, how does that person add value?
Can you give us an example of maybe one project that they worked on that involved helping a local community, a poor community, address maybe some of their needs, and how you would assess it, like what you found problematic about it? Because you are describing a firm, and a lot of these people in your book, they come off as very hardworking, very interesting people with a lot of interests in not just in design, but in art and music, and you know, some of them do a lot of very interesting work outside of work, just kind of with their hobbies and their avocations. So if you can give an example of what they do and also kind of highlight what you found problematic about it, that'd be helpful.
Yeah, so the first project that I studied when I went to work with DevDesign was actually the project that kind of messed with my own faith in design, because when I started working on this book, I had been a user experience designer and I just wanted to make design better. Actually, this is back, you know, 10 years ago. But the project was to figure out what is a low-cost water filter that, you know, poor people in India and Southeast Asia, maybe parts of Africa, would be able to afford. So the studio took a bunch of existing water filters, they put them in people's houses in rural Andhra Pradesh, and then they followed them for several months to see, like, are they able to maintain these water filters? Do they find them useful? Do they just kind of toss them to the side? You know, what can we learn about how to make a water filter that poor people actually want? Now, that all sounds like what I was trained to do when I was trained to be a designer as well. Like, they were doing the right thing, world-class design skills. But there was a kink where when the designers went and were interviewing people about their needs in relation to clean water, tons of people said, we need fluoride filtering. There's too much fluoride in this water. You know, in terms of bacteria in the water, like, we know how to boil water. You know, we don't have a lot of problems with that in our community, but if you can help us get the fluoride out, that's what we actually need help with. But the NGO that was the client and the foundation that was funding them had already decided that clean water meant bacteria-free water. So one, there's these like World Health Organization statistics that get used to prioritize global health needs. So needs that are local to major regions of Asia, like, actually seem too small to tackle in the wake of a need that's like One in five children are dying of diarrhea every 5 seconds, a statistic that I was not able to find the provenance of, by the way, and I tried. The other issue was that fluorosis is a disease you get when you have too much fluoride. Fluoride filtering requires, the technology that was available required electricity, and so it required a lot more R&D to figure out how to make a fluoride filter that would work in low power areas. And nobody really wanted to invest that R&D. The nonprofit that had the funding from the foundation didn't want to overrun their project budget. The foundation had its priorities. So the challenge became, how do you design a water filter that filters for bacteria when people know and their doctors know and their teachers know that what they really need is a fluoride filter? And so the project kind of turned to, well, oh, maybe we can use people's desire for status to have a nice object in their house, or to look like they're earning well, or, you know, to not want to marry their daughter into a house that doesn't have the right kind of water filter. Like, it became about, how do you kind of Trojan horse this thing that people don't necessarily think that they need into their lives? And one of the things that I found really powerful, it never occurred to me as the person doing the fieldwork, and it didn't seem to occur to anyone else on the team as designers who had very similar training to what I had at the time when I was starting this fieldwork. It never occurred to us to go, hey, are there social movements in this region that are trying to work on the fluoride problem? Is there something that we can do to actually help them, or to help them build up more pressure to get governments or foundations to actually invest in this problem that people are saying that they had? Engaging in politics that actually kind of force resources to be made available when investors and companies don't want to make them available, like, that was not part of the repertoire of design, of social innovation. And I kind of came to understand that as part of the point of these disciplines that kind of make improving the human condition a kind of technical and aesthetic exercise, but not a political exercise.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Lily Irani is my guest in studio, and her new book is Chasing Innovation, Making Entrepreneurial Citizens in Modern India. Could you talk more about that, this argument you make in your book that these kind of technocratic interventions depoliticize things, or at least that they ignore politics, put it aside in favor of something else?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of people who've made arguments that technocratic interventions displace politics because, you know, we have an objective answer for how to get to better health or better economic development, and we don't need to take into account different needs people have, different kinds of cultures or communities or aspirations that they have. There's like no contestation there. And like, a lot of people have written about that in development. The thing that I found really interesting was that the people that I was working with were people who actually had political frustrations with how liberalization in India had been going. They were involved in protests around government corruption. Some of them had family members who were involved in activism against violence against lower caste people and Muslims in India. So it wasn't like politics was, it wasn't like there was like an absence of politics, but there was this kind of channeling of, hey, these things that you have as political frustrations, you don't really see a chance to make those changes you want to see through the state. Maybe because the states, you don't feel like they're listening. Maybe because you're not connected to big social movement organizations. Maybe because there is a history with planning in India where, you know, being a communist, for example, would be seen as being too ideological and not just kind of taking the facts into account. So like, that history was also kind of haunting the situation. And so you can actually make the thing that is politically upsetting you into an opportunity to do a kind of social enterprise. So it's not just that people believe in expertise here. It's also that they kind of have lost belief in the state, but they also hope that the state gets better. Like, the people I was working with, they were trying to meet with bureaucrats. They were trying to get involved. But in the meantime, like, your political dissatisfaction could still become something that could make an interesting new product that Procter & Gamble could adopt or a venture capitalist could invest in. So I call this rendering entrepreneurial in the book, where it's not just that we people believe in one kind of expertise. They actually want all kinds of expertise. Bring your feminism to the hackathon. Bring your anti-caste politics to, transforming water access in a village. And if you can scale that up into something that can be invested in and sold, well, then all the better. Then politics can also produce innovation. But as long as it doesn't produce too much contestation or instability in the state.
You also write about, among other things, your participation in a hackathon. This hackathon was put together, was coordinated by this studio, Dev Design Studio. And this is where, as you write, software engineers and designers, they come together, they build relationships, they test their skills, and they produce a demo. So, you know, they kind of figure out a project to work on, and they work and they try and, in a very short amount of time, produce some kind of a thing that they can say might help. Now, we don't have time, unfortunately, for you to describe too much in detail what this hackathon was and all the different participants, although that was very interesting to me and will be of interest to people who read this book, Chasing Innovation. But I wanted to go to the three key things that you write undergirded or propelled the hackathon. And because I think they're all very interesting. One is a bias to action. What is that?
So bias to action is this idea that rather than thinking really hard about a problem that you're facing, you know, like analyzing its history, analyzing its dynamics, you should try things and then learn about the problem by trying things, maybe failing and then iterating. So we see this all over design where you make a prototype and you put it out there, you test it and you learn. But actually, I traced it back to the 1980s business school work by Peters and Waterman, these McKinsey consultants who were talking about, okay, the American corporation is facing economic competition in the form of, you know, other countries coming and competing with the stuff that they manufacture. How can they? We also kind of start to see like chaos theory and cybernetics theories that add up to, well, you can't really know what's going to happen in the future because there's these really complex systems. So the corporation should try things and learn things rather than trying to plan things out in some Robert McNamara fashion.
Well, you mentioned democracy earlier or democratic instincts or democratic practices. What impact do you think this bias to action has on prospects for operating democratically?
So the bias to action ended up being almost like a habit of how people feel and how fast they want to move and do things. And one of the things that I saw over and over was that trying to push a project to something that you could try out made people kind of unwilling to take the time to deal with like real differences that might come up in a project or real differences between how a group of, say, designers or entrepreneurs, real differences they have with the community that they think that they want to be working with. It doesn't leave any time for building trust or for undoing and unlearning the bad habits that you might have because of the kinds of privilege that you've come into the situation with. It makes all of those slower process a kind of threat to innovating and trying stuff out rather than actually where the real learning happens and where something like more democratic participation and coming together could happen.
Another factor you cite, and again, the way this hackathon played out, but also I think in general and just in terms of how entrepreneurial citizenship is enacted, is management of the political and of conflict. So does this go back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, you have all this creativity, and so then there's supposedly opportunity and progress, but you're pushing aside or you're eliding the political?
Yeah. The thing it connects to is the ways that people were asked to bring their political hopefulness to the table at these events. Like, these events are often like civic hackathons or social innovation competitions or festivals of design where people are, you know, sometimes designers, but sometimes activists. Like, the innovation was being staged in these places where they really invited people to bring social movements language in and kind of real social problems in. But it was in the service of finding new sites for innovation or new sites for investment or new sites for kind of social corporate social responsibility projects. So the management of the political is not the evacuation of the political, because you actually need the political is like that little piece of sand that's going to scratch the inside of the oyster to like make the pearl. You want the inspiration that the political provides, but you don't want the actual contestation or like reorganizing of power that the political usually implies. I just like to add that this model of innovating by doing design, by going out and listening to people, by having a hackathon where lots of people can show up with their different ideas of what it is they want to build, all of these are actually posed as answers to the top-down model of expertise that development has been critiqued for. But what happens is that all these different voices that are now being brought into the process are being brought into the process in a way that is just enough to open up new market opportunities, but closes down actually dealing with the kinds of political struggles that would be necessary to pursue some of those visions.
And then the third factor has to do, I think, with what gets ignored in terms of kinds of labor by the designers and the engineers.
Yeah. So for me, the hackathon was actually kind of this microcosm of what makes small groups of people think that they can come together and change the world by making stuff that other people can use. You know, what makes people to write software in 2 days? Well, it's tons of software work that's already been done to make open source platforms or WordPress sites or programming libraries. It's system administrators that are keeping the servers running and all those cloud services so you can just like worry about the cool creative design related stuff. It's people working in Foxconn factories who have made computing cheap enough that you can invite a whole bunch of people to come and work on their own computers that are pervasively available among a certain class of people. So the whole dream of like making stuff really fast was based on the materials you needed already kind of being made cheaply and pervasively available through other people's labor. But with design, it's actually the non-digital version of the same thing. Like making a water filter, designers usually didn't think about the factories where that water filter was going to get made. They just assumed that somewhere in the supply chain, somewhere in this global manufacturing economy, those materials and that labor would be cheap enough that, you know, within like as long as the feature set of the filter wasn't too out there, that that the things that they designed, someone else would build it exactly how they designed it. Like that was an assumption they could make, and they didn't have to like think about it. That way that we don't have to like think about all the labor that goes into the things that we make is as old as Marx and commodity fetishism, but the idea that designers and entrepreneurs can change the world is also kind of like, it's like a planning fetishism, that planning is like the only thing that matters because the materials and the work are going to come from somewhere, wherever.
I'm C.S. Song. Lily Irani joins me on Against the Grain, Associate Professor of Communication and Science Studies at UC San Diego and author of Chasing Innovation. Does design thinking encourage would-be entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs to see how they might be complicit in the oppression or exploitation or dispossession of others?
I would say absolutely not. Design thinking encourages people to see themselves as creative interveners in bad situations and, you know, people who are going in to intervene out of like all the generosity, trying to have empathy, trying to listen. But there's no part of design thinking that asks you, how is the life that you lead, how is the privilege that you have actually built on the very structures that have produced the kind of dispossession and poverty that you're trying to address? Like in a way, design thinking says that like the dispossession and oppression itself becomes a market opportunity to show generosity and to build your, even if you're not doing it for profit, to show generosity and to build yourself up as this like generous savior subject.
Okay, so this book, Chasing Innovation, it has, I think, a very deep and interesting critique of entrepreneurial citizenship, this notion of entrepreneurs doing kind of nation building by adding value, or in their mind, adding value to what, for example, communities are doing. But then, of course, as you said earlier, if the project does address a need, but it can't be like, venture capitalists can't get behind it, or big corporations can't get behind it, or there isn't enough profit to be made in it, it won't be done. The project won't be done, and the community won't get what it needs. So I guess my question is the solution in your mind, or is part of the solution to sort of take the profit motive out of it and to try and encourage a kind of entrepreneurship that regardless of kind of the bottom line, if that's possible, actually helps people where they are and does lend expertise in certain ways that are helpful?
I think the question of what happens when you take the profit motive out of entrepreneurialism becomes a question of, you know, how do you design a system that creates the things that people need and distributes it? And so that's ultimately a political question. Profit was supposed to be the thing that would get rid of planning in Hayek and calculate what's, you know, supply and demand are supposed to help you compute where resources should go. And we're saying that mode of calculation is unjust and makes opportunity out of oppression, right? So I see some inklings of people trying to make this, to try to work out this political question in the world we see around us today. So a lot of the tech worker mobilizations that we've been seeing in the Bay Area are partly about the question of, you know, say Google workers not wanting to build a technology of war. Like, that's not a thing that they feel helps them live in the kind of world that they want to live in, and they want to resist having their labor alienated, especially in that form. We have in India, there's actually a tech worker coalition that has started there that is in some cases actually designers that I met through this research that have started to realize that maybe they need more political vehicles to kind of create the sorts of resources that the people that they hope to serve actually need through political demands. And, you know, a lot of our debates about healthcare are also debates about, are we creating the right kinds of treatments? Are we creating the right kinds of contexts that actually even create health? That's a public health question. That's a question of creating universal healthcare systems. That's a question of respecting different kinds of cultural knowledges about how people like live in a healthy way and what that even means to them. So that's not a question that I can answer, but I'm glad that we're not looking to Silicon Valley or to consumer economies to solve that problem through the market as much as we did when I was growing up.
Lily Irani, ethnographer, designer, former technology worker, and associate professor of communication and science studies at the University of California, San Diego. We've been talking about her new book, Chasing Innovation, Making Entrepreneurial Citizens in Modern India. It's published by Princeton University Press. Her last name, again, is spelled Irani. Lily, thanks for writing this book, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for letting me kind of share these stories so we can all learn from them and do better than we've been doing.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.